We're back to late-night cabinet reshuffles as the president wielded the axe last night with the most significant change for the economy in the Treasury after Tito Mboweni decided he'd had enough cooking the budget, a job he had taken on reluctantly when the president first asked him to come back in 2018. Is this a case of the bomb squad coming in to bail out the starting players, or is our bench at risk of bombing out as the ANC doubles down on decades of failed economic policy? Enoch Godongwana, his replacement, has been an enormously influential figure in both the ANC and government policy and decision-making for some time now. But he's also got a rather checkered history in government, having resigned as a deputy minister over a corruption scandal in 2012. Canyon Springs still haunts him. He is the head of the ANC's Economic Transformation Committee, a position that he's occupied for a decade now. A member of the National Planning Commission, whom I spoke to last night on condition of anonymity, said he understands all of the issues better than most inside the party, but worries that he, the finance minister, was pushed to appease the ANC's alliance partners, certainly purveyed as well. The rand initially weakened during the announcement from 1440 to around 1460 to the dollar, but then paired losses and came back to around 1452 this morning. Godongwana inherits a budgetary path of fiscal consolidation that has angered many in the ANC tripartite alliance. And I think his first test really looms in the October mini-budget, where we'll get a first glimpse of whether he'll hold the line against those in the Communist Party and COSATU who would prefer a more free-spending finance minister. And while Godongwana has the benefit of an expected bonanza in tax revenues, largely in the back of booming commodity prices, to fund this new economic relief package, he also has the unenviable task of effectively taking on the unions to keep the public sector wage bill in check. And while many ministers, including those of state security, communications, human settlements, have been reshuffled, they do remain in cabinet. Minister of Defence Nosiviwe Mapisa Nqakula has been dropped and will be redeployed elsewhere. To put things into perspective, I'm joined by Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, Raymond Parsons, a professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, and Isa Mplanga, Chief Economist at Alexander Forbes. Warwick, this reshuffle takes place against the backdrop of the COVID crisis, which continues to ravage the economy, municipalities collapsing, state-owned enterprises in varying stages of collapse. Let's just start with the market reaction to Tito's resignation. The rand barely moved.
Michael, I think that the market has basically taken a view now that the key power institutions within the ANC have bought into the ball that started rolling with Tito Mboweni, and that the reforms that he initiated and started driving are now considered acceptable, certainly within the inner circle. Of course, as you point out, the wider tripartite alliance will have some issues, but the fact of the matter is that the numbers tend to force the issue. I can certainly remember back to the days that, for example, when Gigaba was appointed finance minister, and despite being somewhat dubious about it, I think that the position actually forced him to actually be quite a lot better than we dared hope. And I think that this job, which is possibly the second toughest job in the country after that of president, has a habit of shaping people. As far as Godongwana goes, I guess it seemed to be a steady pair of hands and a political compromise depending on the quarters. So I suppose at this stage the jury is out. I think what we're obviously looking for is that current initiatives will persist.
Isa, if you look at those cuts to key departments and social spending in the February budget, it really hurt the ANC's alliance partners. And I recall at the time having Michael Sachs on a panel, and you could almost see the steam coming out of his ears. And ever since then, there has been a lot more heat on the finance minister. There are rumours now that he was pushed to appease the alliance partners. Firstly, what do you make of those? Do you think he wanted to resign at this stage? And secondly, his replacement, Enoch Godongwana, what is he going to have to do to ensure that he gains the confidence now of the market?
Look, I think as far as the former Finance Minister Tito Mboweni is concerned, he has always said, even last year, that he would actually prefer to step aside, and enjoy his pension in Makgowaskloof. So it's not a surprise. I think also the fact that, there seemed to be a pushback from the social partners, as you said, given his hard line against, some of the expenditures that the social partners tried to push, more recently the basic income grant, but also his stance in terms of public sector salaries and wages. He has pushed that, but also he's almost not begging for a job, gave him an upper hand in terms of actually telling his colleagues how things should be. So you could say, look, it's something that was expected, but the replacement that we have on Mr. Godongwana, I think we are in a safe pair of hands. If you remember, particularly his recent past, as far as policy pronouncement is concerned, it has been pro-growth, it has been constructive. I can take you back to 2017 ANC policy conference. The issue of land expropriation without compensation, he played a very big part in making sure that it's not worded in a way that was going to be detrimental. The insertion of those crucial words without damaging the food security and other sectors of the economy, that was very crucial to change how it was initially phrased. But we can also think about the prescribed assets debate. He was very crucial in making sure that, prescribed assets wasn't a policy that was adopted by the ANC. Those are two that I can, immediately point out that shows his steady hands. You can even add the potential nationalization of the Reserve Bank debate. He pushed back against that. So we know that he's not populist. He's more practical, than trying to appease the politicians. So in my view, we are in safe hands. Whether he will be able to fend off the, social partners' ambitions to increase the welfare, state by spending on basic income grant is a different question. I guess it's going to be his biggest test.
That will be his biggest test on the big at the moment that we know that the president seems to be quite keen on as well. Raymond, your thoughts?
Well, Michael, let me say this, that I've not had a wish list about what I wanted to see the cabinet look like, because I think what's important here is to ask the question, is the revamped cabinet fit for purpose? And what do I mean by that? It's fit for purpose if it provides us with some better governance, with policy direction, and with policy certainty. So what the president said, he said, look, there's a triple challenge. We have to handle the pandemic, we must manage the economy, and we have to deal with the security concerns. So I have 4 points that I'd like to quickly make. The first is that in all this discussion, whether on this program or elsewhere, about what the cabinet should look like, I don't think we can discuss it without taking into account the factional and the political interests that the president has to take into account if he wants to stay in power and achieve the things that we would like to see him achieve. So it's ultimately politics and not economics that has decided how much space he had to maneuver in the cabinet reshuffle. And then secondly, I think it's important to confirm that what you want from a cabinet minister is leadership to ensure that outcomes are delivered where there are delivery failures on a large scale. I like to say you don't want an expert in a cabinet minister. Experts on tap, not on top. And then thirdly, I agree also that the outgoing Minister of Finance has for a long time said that he was a temporary bird of passage. He did respond to a call of duty, and he would like to lay down this burden as soon as possible. So for me also, it was not a surprise. And then finally, my fourth point, if we look at his successor, he's very experienced. I've had some interchange with him from time to time. I was impressed with his pragmatism that he displayed on a number of issues. Yes, even, for example, on some issues, he's more conservative than some of his colleagues. For example, on the basic income grant, he has recently said, look, I don't think that's the way to go. There's another way to go if we want to get job creation and growth and so forth. So I think the test here will be whether, and this is where you've got to see the total picture. We can slice it up like a salami here today, but the fact is, when you get to the medium-term budget policy statement, that will tell you where the rubber will hit the road with the new minister. Business, the markets, and the credit rating agencies will unpack that. So that is only 2 months away. So I think he has a great opportunity now to show us how he will implement our basic policies in such a way that we can also have fiscal sustainability, because that's a very important challenge which we haven't yet fully met and which we'll see further results in the MTBPS in October.
And I think the real test, Warwick, to bring you back in, is whether or not he's going to stick to those debt limits that Tito has put in place, or whether or not some of those political considerations will lead to further slippage, as was evidenced prior to Tito Mboweni assuming the role of the finance minister. And also just in terms of confidence, everyone digging up into Enoch Godongwana's past and now raising the Canyon Springs issue when he was involved with a business associate in an enterprise that seemed to be defrauding pensioners out of their funds at one of the unions. So obviously that now hangs over him, and I'm sure he'll want to get any suspicion out of the way as quickly as possible. Overall, though, are you comfortable that he's the right man for the job?
I think he's a reasonable choice. I mean, when you've listened to the evidence put forward by my colleagues on the panel, I mean, he looks like an all-rounder. And I think it's important to bear in mind that Tito was the kind of guy to start almost a revolutionary change in direction. But within the kind of political animal that the ANC is, perhaps not the kind of guy to carry it through to fruition. And as my colleagues have pointed out, he was in any case a bit tired and fed up. He'd done his civil service and wanted to move on for personal reasons. So there you go.
Deputy Health Minister, I just want to move on now away from the Finance Minister, and we'll have plenty of time to debate what his policies are. I know he doesn't want to nationalise the Reserve Bank. He has put forward policy proposals to compel the bank to play a greater role in funding infrastructure, so potentially prescribed assets or nationalisation through a back door. I think some people are a little bit worried about that, and I see both Raymond and Izar wearing red ties today. Maybe we are slipping a little bit more to the red side of the spectrum with this appointment. I want to move on to Dr. Joe Pakla, who's appointed the Health Minister, and obviously Zweli Mkhize resigning. Iza falling on his sword at the 11th hour. I don't know if he so much fell on his sword or pushed on it. But Joe Pakla taking over in the middle of a pandemic. Do you think it's going to make that much difference, considering that Dr. Nicholas Crisp and Business for South Africa and that collaboration are starting to really gel and make good progress on the vaccine rollout?
Given that we are still fighting a pandemic that's still ravaging lives and the economy the world over, it was a matter of time before the president had to make a full-time minister of health. I believe it's likely going to be a continuation of what we had in terms of the handling of the health response to COVID. Dr. Zweli Mkhize did a very good job in the response, government's response in handling it, and I think we are going to see a continuation of that. But also, if you just look from a different lens, Dr. Joe Pakla did support the president in his campaigning to become president. So essentially bringing people that are in line with him in terms of thinking, it's something that we would have expected, a consolidation of those that see things in his way that is going to implement the policies that he believes in.
And that was probably the most remarkable show of force, Raymond, to bring you in on this point, was shifting state intelligence to underneath him inside the presidency and actually doing away with that that ministry, bringing Sidney Mufumadi in as a special advisor on intelligence. Some say it smacks of the old boss, which had its issues, and many people rightfully worried about centralizing such a key intelligence gathering unit in such a powerful office as that of the president. But it does also indicate that the president is now seeking to really stamp his authority on government.
Yes, Michael, look, I think that from what I've gathered from some of the comments so far, there seems to be a divided opinion on whether it should be centralized to the extent that it now will be in the presidency. But the fact that a serious restructuring was necessary, because we've been facing clear and present dangers, not only the recent past, but perhaps even in the future, it was clear that some restructuring was absolutely necessary. I think what will happen in the long run in regard to the handling of our state security and intelligence matters will depend really on two factors. The first is whether we read this change as a transitional arrangement for just for the moment, because of what has to be dealt with immediately, and to give the president the confidence that he's on top of what's happening there and that he will get the answers and the advice that he needs to handle the issues of intelligence and security in future. The second factor that will determine the longer run outcome will, of course, be this panel that's been appointed to look into the whole security system. And it may well be then when they've completed their work, they might come up with some recommendations as to how the intelligence and security agencies ought to be best structured in future. So I think we really ought to suspend final judgment now. There are certain things that have to be done immediately. The president has felt he needs to put his stamp on it now, but it could well be that over time, other structures will evolve that will serve us on the intelligence and the security front better in the longer run.
We're putting an eventful week into perspective with Isaac Mplangaa, Raymond Parsons and Warwick Lucas. And the latest events flowing from the civil unrest as well as the cyber attacks on Transnet have again just emphasized the vulnerabilities of a small open economy like ours, whose GDP is about 60% dependent on foreign trade. Now, Transnet temporarily backed out of its commitment to move goods in and out of South Africa by declaring force majeure. This has had widespread economic and business consequences, including for South Africa's global competitiveness. We've seen supply chains disrupted, costly delays experienced, and the long-standing and persistent weaknesses in South Africa's port structure, already ranked very low globally, have been ruthlessly exposed. Raymond, what are some of the lessons here emanating from the Transnet debacle?
Well, Michael, I'm reminded of that saying. It was Warren Buffett who said that when the tide goes out, you see who's been swimming naked. And Transnet was obviously caught swimming naked. It's been exposed by the cyber attack. And it's quite clear that one of the first things we'll have to do will be to upgrade its cyber defenses. One of the more structural issues that seems to come through to me, and perhaps my colleagues will add to it later, is that it almost seems that your size is a disadvantage. In other words, the Transnet, because it straddles so many aspects of our supply chains, is simply too big. We have got too many eggs in the Transnet basket, and just as we've now decided that we're going to create a separate port authority, we need to take that a bit further now and say, but aren't we exposed to other risks that would be better handled if we could diversify some key aspects of Transnet? So I think that what we need to ask ourselves now in the light of this experience, other than wanting to play, you know, a sort of blame game, we must look ahead and say, how can we minimize these risks and make Transnet more efficient in future? And I think just to highlight another structural defect, we've been obsessed, of course, with what happened with the N3. Why has the N3 become a strategic artery? Because Transnet is unable, through its railway system, to carry the goods that ought not to be on the road. Therefore, all these trucks are diverted, or a large number, onto an artery, which then becomes a very simple target to disrupt and undermine. So that's another aspect. I think it's an opportunity. Although we're taking the cyber attack as the peg on which to hang this discussion, I think we need to open up a wider discussion as to what are the remedies and reforms we now need to seriously see at Transnet in the light of our recent experiences.
I'm going to build on that, Isa. What would you like to see happen in order to use what's going on currently at Transnet to speed up the reforms? We know our ports are amongst the worst in the world when it comes to TEUs and moving containers in and out of the country. And in the middle of a commodity boom like this, we really need to be ensuring that we don't have those kinds of structural bottlenecks that could potentially curtail growth. What would you like to see happen?
I think the National Treasury paper on economic reforms already set out what needs to be done in the network industries, which includes Transnet. And that is opening up the railway system to the private sector. But what we have already seen with the unbundling of the ports authority from Transnet as a precursor, I hope, to the introduction of strategic equity partners that are going to introduce a new and different way of managing is very important. So we don't need to come up with completely new things because we just haven't implemented the current reforms that are on the table. So to really make sure that we introduce the private sector into the running of some of those railway lines, and actually it can attract investment first, but it can also make sure that they are efficient. You know, one of the issues that was raised in one conference that I attended last week, where we had executive from VW, and I asked them a simple question: what is your biggest impediment or your biggest costs in operating in South Africa? And they mentioned logistics. It wasn't electricity, it wasn't labor, it was logistics. So that just shows how important we need to actually deal with the transformation and reform of Transnet in the railway system to enable most of the goods that are produced locally to be able to be shipped into international markets.
And building on that, yesterday, Warwick, I was chatting to Steve Binney, the CEO of SAPI, at their results. And they're the second biggest exporter out of the Durban port. And the cyber attacks in particular have had a hugely disruptive impact on their ability to meet client contractual demands exporting through that port. So he says the firm has suffered huge reputational damage. Sadly, you don't see the line ministers really sticking their heads up. Well, where's Pravin Gordhan? Where are our Porsche Derby at Transnet? You don't really hear them, even though they might be trying to lead in the background. We need to be seen to be doing something about Transnet at the moment.
Pretty much so, Michael. I mean, we have, I guess, the cat seems to have some people's tongues. But be that as it may, I mean, in a typical, certainly manufacturing enterprise, I mean, logistics is usually you could thumbsuck a figure of at least 10 to 12% of the overall cost, which actually is usually larger than your profit margin. So it's intensely important, and it's too important just to leave it in the hands of the state. I mean, at the end of the day, why does free enterprise work? It works because there's consequences. So if someone in a business messes up, shareholders climb in, co-colleagues climb in, clients climb in, and that doesn't really happen in government. They seem to be somehow insulated, and I think that needs to come to an end on such a critical component of the national economy.
Michael,
on the last point, absolutely, Raymond, I was just going to put to you as a concluding comment, and to build on the issue of consequences and accountability. We went from a period under Zuma where the cabinet was reshuffled almost too often, where you couldn't actually get anything going, and it was always for political expediency. The president, this is his first major cabinet reshuffle. Does this do enough in terms of drawing the line under this issue of accountability inside his cabinet?
I would just like to say, as a final comment, that I hope that at the first meeting of the new cabinet, that the president will crack the whip and say, I want to see a sense of urgency in what needs to be done in terms of reform and the remedies, whether it's Transnet at one end or our fiscal position at another end. He needs to say, you will be held accountable, and what's more, I'm going to rewrite all your performance agreements so that I have the ammunition with which to measure your performance. I think that is the kind of message that now needs to come through to reinforce the new team and to concentrate their minds wonderfully on what the country needs.
Well, speaking of that new team and who he's brought off the bench, I hope they are more Springbok bomb squad in the second test than Springbok bomb squad in the first test, and that the colour of your ties is not a bad omen ahead of what promises to be a mouth-watering clash against the Lions tomorrow. Thank you very much to our panel, Raymond Parsons, Warwick Lucas and Isa Mplanga, running the rule over the cabinet reshuffle.